Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, regular discussion with people in the North of England who lead businesses, employ people, and have new ideas and policies and things to help our economy grow. The Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR. We serve lots of companies across different sectors, some of which occasionally contribute to the podcast. We're kindly sponsored by Virtue Motors PLC, which is one of the top automotive retailers in the UK. It has lots and lots of different brands it represents, including commercial vehicles, which is represented through Vans Direct. I'm Graham Robb, and today I'm presenting with Jamie Collis in the studio.
Nice to be here again.
It's great to have you. And we've got Marion Marsland. And Marion is CEO at the Thermal Insulation Contractors Association. And down the line, we've got Sarah Newbold, who's Senior Investment Manager for the UK and Regional Funds at the British Business Bank. That's brilliant.
Fantastic. Great to have you both with us. Before we kick off with a chat about what we've been up to and what's going on, let's hear from our two guests first. Mary, let's start with you. Give us your 30-second elevator pitch about who you are and what you do.
Oh, thank you. So I'm Marion Marsland. I look after a trade body who represent thermal insulation contractors. We're a national organisation, but we've been based here in Darlington for the last 25 years. Our main reasons for being include collective bargaining of national agreements, representing for technical standards and regulations. And in addition to that, we are the sector's primary centre for training of apprenticeships and apprentices. In addition to that, we are allied to specialist construction, so very much closely follow the wider construction market.
Yes. And then Sarah, down the line from the British Business Bank, and you've got the behind you for people watching rather than listening, the Northern Powerhouse Investment Fund promotions. What's your bank do and how does it operate?
Hi. So the British Business Bank is the UK government's economic investment bank. We're dedicated to making finance markets work better for smaller businesses across the UK. So we do this by working with delivery partners, that is fund managers and lenders, to provide accessible funding products for smaller businesses. Now, one of the biggest challenges that businesses face is a regional imbalance in access to finance. So it's relatively easy for businesses to access funding in and around London, but research has shown that there's a lack of available capital for businesses outside of London. So at British Business Bank, we've recently launched a £1.6 billion package of funding support for businesses that are based and operating across the wider UK. So specifically in the north, this is via the £660 million Northern Powerhouse Investment Fund 2, or NPIF2, so it's a bit of a mouthful, which we launched in March of this year.
That's great. Okay, we'll get into detail a little bit later. Jamie, we've had a funny old good week, I suppose, in the last 7 days.
Yeah.
It's been quite good.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're Northern Business Podcast, all about the north, but you've ventured out of the north.
Yes, I took the north to the south, and I was quite pleased to do so, actually. I went to and Essex to a big conference of entrepreneurs, and it was quite a big conference. It was addressed by one of the dragons in the Dragon's Den, and I addressed it as well about promoting businesses. There was well over 100 people there, and what was interesting was that we've seen a lot of problems in the economy emerge specifically after the budget, but I got the impression that the entrepreneurial group of people I was talking to, along with people we know, are in defiance of what's happening in the economy, rather like these soldiers that served in Africa and Indian times in colonial days. They defied the heat. Come on, son, do your worst. And these people were really up for tackling the economic decline by investing and marketing new products in an innovative way. And it was great. And as we recognition went south and brought work north, because we won some significant contracts as a result of that outreach, Geordie shoring it, as it were.
And so these SME businesses, a lot of them were those sort of businesses that you met, they are determined, they want to keep...
Yeah, and there was a real passion. It felt like these people were born to be in business. They were naturals. It was very interesting, by the way, the demographic mix. It was in Essex. It was culturally and it was ethnically, culturally, and it was also diverse from the point of view of gender. It wasn't all traditional business men like you so often see in business.
Sat on this side of the couch,
we have a balanced panel today. But sometimes it's difficult doing the Northern Business Podcast, and this group was naturally balanced.
That's true. I mean, as Marion and Sarah will say as well, we've got some great innovative businesses in in this region as well. And one of the things I've been involved with this week, although I didn't go myself, we arranged through Recognition PR, we teamed up with Northeast Times magazine and their sister publication, Be Daily, to support a campaign they've got called Vision 31, which is about basically taking the message that the Northeast is a great place to do business and invest to London. And this was a event that they hosted at the Cheese Grater building, the Aon Insurance building, and had all sorts of people come from all over the country, from London investors, and a group of businesses jumped on the train, marched down like penguins down to London to show what the Northeast can do, and was exceptional in terms of portraying what's going on here and showing things like, Sarah's going to obviously talk about the investment fund, but also funds like Develop North, which is a an alternative lending organisation fund, which is there to help house builders and property developers and stuff. And so it shows that there is willingness in this region to get people to invest, whether they're taking money from this region or bringing money into the region, which is fantastic.
Well, let's pick up on that. And Sarah, let's bring you in. I was privileged to be on that panel in the City of London and talking about the North, which is, you know, I can professionally talk about the North, no problems. When we're in the North, we'll all have a bit of a whinge. But when we're outside the North, we will just go and fly the flag. And it was very, very positive in terms of what there is to invest in. All right, there are some problems in the economy, there's no doubt about that. But when it comes to investable businesses, there are many, many of them. Are you seeing that when your funds open? Are you seeing interesting applications and novel applications?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the most important features of MPIF2 is that we've appointed local fund managers to deliver the finance. So they're delivering that across the whole of the North, and we've got dedicated managers in the Northwest, Yorkshire and Humber, and in the Northeast. So these amazing businesses that we're seeing across the North looking for funding don't have to travel outside of the region. They're able to work with fund managers who operate on the ground and really understand the local market and economic conditions.
Now, you talked about it being the government server. Fund. Is this money taxpayers' money?
Yes, so we're publicly funded. But one of the brilliant things is actually alongside that government money, we're bringing in private sector money. So people are seeing that the investments that we're doing, the things that are happening, and we're leveraging in that private support as well.
I'm just casting my mind behind you, and it's given me prompts on your board. Some of it is debt finance, some of this equity finance, and then for the smaller businesses, they can still take out conventional loans, the kind of things that they might go to the bank for. So why come to you for a loan and not the bank?
Yeah, so really we're trying to fill the gap. So we're trying to invest where traditionally banks may not be interested in investing. So we're offering these, as you say, three funding options. We've got smaller loans between 25,000 and 100,000, larger debt from 100,000 up to 2 million, and their equity option able to invest up to 5 million. So it's really wide ranging and intended to provide tailored support for smaller businesses at all stages in their development that may not be able to access finance from traditional sources.
And are you seeing appetite from the North of England?
We are. We've seen some really, really great things across the North of England.
Now, I wouldn't want to sort of construct an application, but I want to give you a scenario from a company that I do know about that's having problems, but it's not necessarily a company that's approached you, but it would give me an idea, and the listeners and viewers an idea of where you'd sit. So this was a company, it's in manufacturing. It's manufacturing the kind of product that you can buy in a department store. And it's also wanting to manufacture a product that relates to eco-heating. And it's having problems raising money through banks because it had problems during COVID. So the banks have all said, no, you look at your balance sheet, and it was hit hard during COVID. And the company's saying, no, look at the potential. We've got this product stream. We've got that design. We've got those people making it. We're ready to go. Lend us the money. And they're looking for sort of £1 million. And most banks are saying no because of the historic balance sheet during COVID. Is that the kind of company that should be talking to you? Or are you interested in companies that are not having any kind of distress?
Absolutely. I mean, our fund managers and the investments that they're looking to make are forward-looking. So it's projection-led lending speak. So we're looking at what the company can achieve. We're looking at a really strong business plan covering the next few years. And it's all about growth. So we want to support companies that have got that ambition to grow. And that is our key focus. So yeah, projection-led and forward-looking.
And does the fund have any target focuses, you know, in terms of things like tech or as we say, manufacturing, or is it agnostic? Will it just support business if it's got a good case that you can invest in?
Yeah, no, one of the brilliant things about the fund is that it is sector agnostic. There's very few restrictions, actually. So during this first year, we've really seen a diverse range of investments across so many different important sectors. For example, we've supported businesses in technology, retail and consumer, life science, manufacturing. But in terms of focus, there are a number of areas where we're particularly keen to see that support. So one of our key objectives at the British Business Bank is enabling the UK's transition to a net zero economy. So as part of that, we want the funds to be investing in businesses with strong green credentials and providing innovative net zero solutions. And another thing that's important to us is helping address wider imbalances in access to finance. So typically female-led businesses, those led by Black, Asian and ethnic minority founders, do struggle to access finance to support their business growth. So it's really important to us that our fund managers are actively working to reach those underrepresented members of the business community.
That's fantastic. Can I ask you are taxpayer funded, and there's a strange question in this, because whatever answer you give, you can't really win. On one hand, I just talked about a company that was in distress that would be, or had passed distress, that was being turned down for commercial banks. Why would the taxpayer, me, Jamie, Marion, and you, want to fund that and put our money at risk? On the other hand, if the taxpayer doesn't get in and fund this kind of business, it won't go anywhere. So is your risk appetite better, worse than the banks?
Yeah, I mean, this is a commercial fund. So obviously we want to make a return on the investment. We want to be kind of sensible with taxpayers' money. So yeah, I wouldn't say that we've got a higher risk appetite. I just think that we've kind of got that portfolio approach where we're able to invest in that very early stage, smaller kind of business. And that's kind of balanced out with some of the larger equity investments as well that we do.
Right. It's a weird question, isn't it? Because if you are taking the same commercial appetite to risk, then what's the point? You're buying on the banks to it. But if you were taking a little bit more of a risk approach, then
politicians are
flighty with money.
Yeah, we work with the banks in lots of cases. So there may be one where the bank is able to invest up to a point, right, but there's still a gap and the company doesn't have quite enough funding to kind of complete that growth journey. So they're kind of underfunded in that respect. And so that's where we can come in and kind of plug that gap.
That's a great answer. That really does explain it. Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
But before we turn to Marion, just quickly, plug opportunity. How do people find out more about the fund?
Yeah, so if you visit our website, the British Business Bank website, we've got a dedicated page to the Northern Powerhouse Investment Fund too. Lots of examples on there, lots of case studies of what we've already done, and obviously the links to the fund manager's website so you can get in touch.
Great. Okay, we might come back to you. Feel free to chip in.
Yeah, no, definitely. So, Marion, just to bridge from there, talking about, obviously, you're a trade association, so you have lots of members who are small and private businesses of all different sizes. What are they saying to you about how the economy is going and what they're concerned about?
I think there's a very good link there, actually, between what Sarah was talking about in terms of investing in businesses with a drive to net zero. I think there's a big question mark currently about I think it's less clear now in terms of government's intentions for net zero. Mm. Will we make it or won't we make it? And how are we going to do that? And we're seeing a knock on in terms of the economy and decisions that are being made and actually stalling business because there is no clear direction. But it's really interesting. Listen to what Sarah says about investment and small businesses. Actually, what's holding specialists back in construction, especially who want to go out and drive net zero, which obviously our members do. We're talking about thermal insulation on an industrial scale, on industrialized areas where we're looking to decarbonize. The problem there is manpower and skills shortage. It's not actually finance. I would say probably a bigger problem holding back our sector than funding is actually finding people who can do the job, and linking that back to that net zero, whatever it is that we're going to fund. You would imagine that's going to lead to an action that somebody's actually going to do. So we don't have, we've got very strict controls on immigration and workers coming into the UK. We've never had more NEETs, not in employment, education or training. We've got a vast amount of young people who don't know how to get a job. I was reading on the BBC News yesterday. And we've got a massive skills shortage, a massive availability of people. So we get the funding in place. We've got the drive to get to net zero, but we still need somebody to actually do that job.
Now, you're at the sharp end of this. I've seen your place in Darlington where you've got all these rigs and young people coming in and learning how to do it. So you're actually delivering the training, and you've got a campaign called One More Apprentice. Tell us about that campaign.
So like any trade association, we don't have exclusivity across every insulation contractor in the UK. I would say we would cover about 40% of UK contractors. That leaves 60% that are not a member of a trade association, that are not contributing and are not training. That's an awful lot of employers that could offer a learner journey. An apprenticeship is 80% employer-led. You're with your employer. If we don't have an employer prepared to take that journey on, it doesn't matter how many apprentices we've got willing to come on board, they need an employer, they need a vehicle to jump on board and offer them that training pathway.
So is that where the gap is when they talk about the skills gap in terms of that? Because previously it used to be the issue was there was not enough young people wanting to do apprenticeships. They were pushed towards university. It was, you know, education, education, education from Tony Blair's Labour government. It was all about going to university. And then apprenticeships started to take a bit more prominence, trying to get people back. But it's actually finding them employers to take them on is the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to talk specifically now about specialist construction. And if you look at anybody below a tier one contractor, they don't actually employ anybody. We build on an army of subcontractors who are self-employed.
The men in vans, they're an important part of the economy, but they also don't have the reach to do this training.
Well, they're not employed is the critical thing. And if you have a business, we have some of our members, particularly in London, who may be turning over 15 to 20 million pounds who don't employ anybody. This is self-employed labour. If you are to take an apprentice on board, you're taking government funds to do that. The public purse, that apprentice needs a supervisor. He needs supervision. He needs a mentor. He needs somebody who's employed and with him on the job all the time. If you have a subcontract workforce, they will not take responsibility for your apprentice. So everything that you said there, Jamie, hits construction in terms of finding skills, the drive to university. Post-COVID, mental health issues amongst young people is at its highest. There is a myriad of things colliding. It's not as simple as one thing. There are many, many factors that means it's very hard to find the numbers that we need. When we do find the numbers that we need, and we've been very successful at that in TICA, up to 5 years ago, we were training 60 apprentices a year. We're training 200 now. That's a massive improvement. But the more employers that we can bring into the fold who are prepared to offer a journey, we know for the numbers that we need, we can go out and find them an apprentice. It's a combination of the two, match an employer with an apprentice.
Can I ask about and this is something I always get confused about, and lots of people in business don't fully understand how it works, the apprenticeship levy.
Okay.
And I saw the government minister, Bridget Phillipson, was on BBC television this week saying that it's got to be reviewed and reformed because it isn't really working. Big companies pay it. Small companies don't necessarily pay it. It seems like it's migrated to be a tax. Is it the right approach? Should it just be a tax incentive? Should it be able to deduct costs of apprenticeships from the tax return as an incentive rather than a levy?
Well, I don't think it's migrated to be a tax. I think it's always been a tax. Yeah,
It's always not called a tax because it really was.
Large employers with a payroll, for the levy is classed as a payroll of 3 million plus.
Yeah.
So if you've got 3 million more on your payroll, you will pay that tax in effect.
Unless you do a certain type of apprenticeship training.
Well, you'll pay an apprenticeship training levy, irrespective of what you do, over £3 million.
And that supposedly goes into a pot.
It goes into a pot. Yeah. We would argue very strongly that the model has worked extremely well for us. You're right, large employers pay it, small employers don't. However, it's small employers who train apprentices, not large employers.
Right.
And if all of a sudden that pot gets looked at, amended in any kind of way, is there a pot of money that the government are then going to put in place to continue small employers to provide those journeys? Because if that pot is reduced,
then they suffer.
Then they suffer. And then the apprenticeship will suffer, because if you look at the data of who's actually training apprentices, 75% of them will be SMEs.
So when you hear a government minister saying they want to reform the apprenticeship levy because it isn't working, you think, well, leave it all well alone, please.
I have to wear two very different hats. If our major members were listening to me, they'd love reform. But that's because they'd like to spend the training levy on mandatory training, health and safety, manual handling, lots of other things that are not an apprenticeship. Data shows that when employers are forced to put money aside for apprenticeship training, they will spend it because they feel that it's their money. That's not the way the government see it, but it puts a focus on apprenticeship training. And for me, it links back to what you've already touched on, Jamie, there, which is identification. Mm. You know, as a mother, wearing my parent hat, I understand what a degree is. It might not be right for my son or daughter, but I understand the value in it. If somebody says apprenticeship to me, as somebody who delivers apprenticeships, I'm still thinking, is that the right thing? How valuable will it be in 5 years' time? Whereas if you look to Germany or Europe, European model, that apprenticeship model is very highly recognised and therefore it's valued. Mm. Yeah. So the training levy has given consistency and a real focus. It's not perfect. There isn't a perfect system out there. But I would argue quite strongly for TICA, that has driven our numbers. And we had a really critical skill shortage.
Mm. Well, it's making a difference to the sector. And you are perhaps one of the success stories that shows the way trades that are critical to growth should be looking at the future skills.
I hope so.
Well, Marion, thank you. Sarah, thank you for joining us. And I'm sure that there'll be businesses that have listened and watched this podcast who can definitely use a conversation about the, well, how did you call it? Northern Power, you call it NIF?
NIF2. Northern Powerhouse Investment Fund 2. So NIF2. And yeah, absolutely. I really hope there is.
Love an acronym. If it's not an acronym, it's a business phrase. The one that I got me the other day was, move the needle. That's one I've not heard before, but it keeps coming up. And then it's circle back. Yeah. And then it's skin in the game.
He had a great LinkedIn post with all this. Loads of people were joining.
Oh, it's it. People love it. The things, you know, the business phrases that we hate. Ducks in a row.
Low hanging fruit.
Honestly, drives tell you what, distraction.
We've got to take this offline now. Oh, thank you for joining us as a guest on the Northern Business Podcast. If you want to be on, do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks to the producer, Harry Sinclair, and technical operator, Robin Campbell. Join us next time. Don't miss an episode. Like, rate, and subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.